It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Joe Biden was in Pennsylvania, found his way to Allentown, to the Mack truck plant there in Macungie. Sixth president in a row to visit the Mack truck plant there in Macungie. Six in a row. This is a significant manufacturing facility. One of the main key truck manufacturers in the country right here at home. And it's one of those things that everyone loves to go to and say, oh, look, American workers, union work and all of that stuff. Joe Biden's the first guy who said, look, you know, I reject out of hand this defeatist view that the forces of automation and globalization mean we can't have good paying union jobs in America. And that plant shows it. Look, they make a great product. People love the iconic Mack truck. We can do these things with American labor, if this is one of those ifs, if the policies are put into place to make sure that we do, and we expect it, we the people demand it. And I've been saying for a long time, I always look, I look for Buy American, first I look for Buy American made by union workers, and I look for Buy American, then I look for, stuff made by union workers. That's how my pecking order goes when I make a purchase. And you ask the kids, we'll go and we'll look at something and go, okay, what's the, we want to see where things are made. We need to be more activist consumers. We need to demand that the things that we consume made right here at home by our neighbors, well, by ourselves probably. So glad to see Joe Biden in town. Glad to see him talking about Buy American, laid out the way forward, going to use government procurement to buy things that we make here. And you go, that shouldn't even be a story. That should have been a given. That should have been going on all along. But sadly, we've allowed corporate America to abandon our shores while we give them whatever they want, all the tax breaks and all the handouts and subsidies and all that stuff. And now you've got a president. And look, Joe Biden wasn't my first guy, but I'm thrilled by the fact that he's singing the right songs, man. He's hitting the right notes. The chord progression is spot on. Now, what do we do with it? Can we get Congress to get their heads out of their behinds long enough? Can we get them to stop fighting long enough? Can we get them to stop disagreeing long enough? I don't know. I am hopeful. That's why today I was pleasantly surprised that the Senate, the first it was the Senate has, we brokered a deal. There is a deal. $1.2 trillion over 8 years, $550 billion in new spending. We're gonna work on our infrastructure. And then a little bit later, the cloture vote came, advanced the bill 6732. Looks like we're going to get it done. Looks like it might. Again, this is a might. This is a might. I am not sold on the idea that we're getting any infrastructure bill, because leave it to Democrats to figure out how to screw that up. And giving Republicans the ability to help come along. But the $1.2 trillion hard infrastructure plan, that's going to have $110 billion in new funding for roads and bridges and major projects like that. $40 billion of which bridge repair, because we desperately need it. Replace some bridges, rehabilitation, that stuff. Also, $73 billion to upgrade our electrical grid. Haven't needed that for several decades, but gonna move in that direction. $65 billion to get us the broadband that we need, because rural communities have been getting really the short end of the stick for way too long. $55 billion for clean drinking water, because, you kind of need that. Maybe we clean up some of those lead pipes. Also, $50 billion for flooding and coastal resilience. Personally, I say just move back a little bit. If you bought the house on the water, that's on you. You get one bailout. If you rebuilt and put it right back there without mitigating or without doing stuff, that's on you going forward. Just my thoughts. But you know, Chuck Schumer did come out and say that he was gonna keep them through the weekend because no recess without it. Looks like it might happen. Now everyone was happy. Things were good. I was questioning why today was the day that it came out after the hearings yesterday, so this could steal the headlines. And I was going, you know, this is, you know, a little curious. We need it. We need to get it done, but a little curious. And the news was, hey, good. It was something bipartisan. We're going to get this done. And then Kristen Simina. What can you say about Senator Dipsy Doo from Arizona? I remember, you remember her with her little funny skirt on, doing that little dance where she did the thumbs down for the minimum wage increase. And she didn't need to do it. It wasn't going to pass anyway. She had to put that little body English on it, do a little dance, you know, a little curtsy kind of thing. She came out today and said that, well, the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation infrastructure bill, just too high for her. And this sent, you know, everything into chaos because guess what could possibly happen? And this was doomsday scenario I talked about months ago, that we could end up with nothing. Because Senator Dipsy Doo here is saying, nope, we're not moving on. That's too much. We're not doing it. Maybe they can whittle that down a little bit. But now you've got House Democrats who are going to have to go, wait a second. We were told we're going to get that bipartisan bill of just the hard infrastructure stuff, and then we were simultaneously going to move the legislation to help us get the human infrastructure that we need. You know, help for senior citizens, help for to educate children. You know, the human infrastructure that's been lacking for so long. It's going to be interesting to see how the House Democrats play this. Because remember, they were told both bills were gonna pass together. They were gonna get what they could get in a bipartisan fashion, and then they were going to go ahead and move on the things that are really our society needs desperately. And they were gonna go that alone. You know, starting to address climate change. You know, starting to do something about making, you know, a two-year college degree more accessible. A bunch of stuff that's in that to help move us forward and to help us do a little bit better. Now you've got the good senator from Arizona saying, well, no, we're not going to do that. And again, this is what I always expect from Democrats. It's that circular firing squad that they're so famous for. This is one of those things that by having such a big tent, you end up with characters like Simina. You end up like characters like Manchin. And look, I think Manchin would come along on a big spending bill because his state desperately needs it. Now, what's weird is Manchin can basically do whatever he wants because he's in a solidly red state. And no one's really going to push him too hard. Sinema is in a swing state. And, you know, what does that say for her reelection in the event that we actually get nothing? Because I've taken the position, if we get nothing, if this doesn't get through, Joe Biden's going to have a rough 2 years. Because the Democrats are going to lose both the House and the Senate. And you will see an impeachment of Joe Biden immediately for no reason. There will be no reason. They'll pull out the 25th Amendment. They'll pull out whatever they need to do to get him ousted. And then they'll go after Kamala Harris as well. This sadly, and I go back to the hearings yesterday. We're in this weird kind of world. We're in this weird kind of world where the Republicans want power more than they want democracy. They want to be able to control everything. The vote of the people, the will of the people, be damned. Because you know, you think about the things over the years that have died at the hands of Republicans. Labor law reform, education reform, single-payer health care. Go down the list. They haven't come up with an actual plan on how to make lives better. They simply spend their time in figuring out how to divide and pit us against each other, keep us at each other's throat. I truly believe, and this is one of those things where if 5 years ago, I would have never said what I'm going to say now. 5 years ago, I would have never believed it possible. 5 years ago, I would have said, that's insane. Could never happen here. We're better than that. But I do believe the current Republican leadership, if they gain control of the House and Senate, will impeach Biden immediately for nothing. And Harris will go as well. So that whoever the Speaker of the House is, and who knows, maybe they do try and make Donald Trump Speaker of the House. That's been thrown around a number of times already. That's on the Republican agenda. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. They would bring him back as Speaker of the House, impeach both Biden and Harris, and reinstall him. Now, it would be later than here in the next couple of weeks, because we were told in the next couple of weeks, I'm still waiting to see if he's reinstalled. But it could be just another year and a half down the road. And this is where the incredible part for me is. I don't think the Republican Party would care. They would justify it. As well, they stole the last election. Because this is why all this Stop the Steal stuff is still going on. I don't know that they really believed that they were going to be able to overthrow our government. I don't know that they really believe that at the higher levels. At the minion levels, all of the folks who showed up ready to, really seriously ready to hang representatives, even hang the vice president, I truly believe they thought this is our time. This is our time to take over. This is our time to instill our guy. But the upper folks, I don't know. I don't think they thought it was possible. And look, if it's not for our military leaders, which again, I can't believe we're saying, we could quite possibly be in a moment with a fascist dictator. I mean, think about that for a second. And like I said, look, 5 years ago when he took office, I said it was going to be bad. It was going to be horrible, but we would work through it. We would get through the horrible time because we believe in democracy. We believe in our institutions. We believe in our constitution. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in the sanctity of the ballot box. We believe in these things, only to now find out that, well, only one party really does. And the other is willing, ready, and able to burn all of that down for pure political power. That, to me, is just remarkable. And beyond where my mind was able to take me on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2017. Now, I've had some people go, no, Rick, I was there. I was expecting all of this. I wasn't there. I knew it was going to be bad. I knew the criming would happen, and the criming would happen often. I knew this would be the most corrupt administration in our history. I knew there were going to be, tons of hearings and court battles and perp walks. Didn't realize it was going to be this kind of bad. Now, maybe I should have seen it. Maybe I should have been able to read the pulse of the anger of the people who support him. Because I've been saying that, look, the working class of this country is extremely angry. Because they haven't been able to live the lives that they were promised. That economic ability that their parents had. Because we always believe we're going to do better. We got better up. The future's bright. And for a lot of people, they're struggling. struggling to keep the lights on, struggling to keep a roof over their heads, struggling to keep the kids fed, worried about college costs that are going through the roof. And instead of using the ability of government to address those issues, they've been sold, spoon-fed on the idea that, no, we need the very wealthy to bail us out through handouts to them that will eventually trickle down to us in some weird way. And then everything, once it's privatized, will be better. And we find out that that was completely backwards. The more we privatize, the worse our lives get. The more we hand over to corporate America, the higher things cost. The more that we give to the 1%, the harder it is for us to attain. It wasn't surprising when they laid it out, but it's what it's turned into. And the question is, how much are we going to allow? And this is a soul-searching moment for my Republican friends, because I've had a couple of conversations with people who truly don't believe January 6th was that big of a deal. They truly believe it was just, people walking into their house, and that they really weren't going to hurt anyone. They really weren't going to hang anyone. They just built the gallows as a prop. That they're good people. Good God-fearing Christian people. Who were, if you listened to the testimony yesterday, beating and tasing and calling racial names and threatening to kill people that they claim that they love. People that they claim they idolize. That they back. With that kind of idolization, I don't want people idolizing me. And we have to get to the bottom of this. We have to hold those accountable who did the horrible things on January 6th. And they have to go to jail. From the top all the way down. But especially the top. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dr. Allison Gill is going to be here to share some thoughts on the hearing yesterday and maybe what we get to out of this January 6th select committee. Quick break. Right back with Dr. Gill. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day more than 10,000 African Americans marched down New York's Fifth Avenue in what is known as the Silent Parade. The protest came in the aftermath of the July 2nd East St. Louis race riot and a number of lynchings in Texas. Organized by black scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, and the NAACP, the Silent Parade protested lynchings and anti-black violence. Children led the march dressed in white. Women, who were also dressed in white, followed them. Men dressed in dark suits marched behind. It was considered the first public protest of racial violence in the United States. Alexis Newman describes the scene as the parade proceeds to Madison Square. The marchers carried banners and posters stating their reasons for the march. Both participants and onlookers remarked that this protest was unlike any other seen in the city and the nation. There were no chants, no songs, just silence. Some signs read, "Mother, do lynchers go to heaven?" and "Mr. President, why not make America safe for democracy?" Protesters hoped President Woodrow Wilson would make good on his election promises to promote rights for blacks. But Wilson took no action. In fact, he opposed anti-lynching legislation and continued segregationist policies in federal offices. In an editorial for the New York Age, James Weldon Johnson pointed out, quote, that their brothers and sisters, people just like them, were Jim Crowed and segregated and disenfranchised and oppressed and lynched and burned alive in this, the greatest republic in the world, the great leader in the fight for democracy and humanity. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Liz Cheney had an interesting statement yesterday. And again, I can't believe a Cheney. I can't believe that I'm holding out hope that a Cheney is going to save the country after spending 8 years of misery with her father, Darth Cheney, who surprisingly still is alive. I mean, that's the weird thing. And, you know, look, at the end of it, as I've said before, the only thing I've heard of a Cheney is just shoot somebody in the face already. That's kind of what I was hoping the story is. Maybe she'd have shot Jim Jordan in the face. But Liz Cheney came out and said, we can't leave the violence of January 6th and its causes uninvestigated. I agree. She says, we must know what happened every minute of that day in the White House, every phone call, every conversation, every meeting leading up to, during, and after the attack. She added that if those responsible are not held accountable and if Congress does not act responsibly, we will face the threat of more violence in the months to come and another January 6th every 4 years. And I agree with her. This is the weird part of this. Because I've been saying that these people are riled up, ready for the next civil war. This is just giving them license. And here to share some thoughts on the hearing, Liz Cheney's statement, and maybe where we end up here, on down the road. I've asked our good friend, Dr. Allison Gill, to come talk with us. Allison is the host of the Mueller She Wrote podcast and also Daily Beans pod as well. Allison, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
So Cheney comes out and says, look, we got to get to the bottom of this. This is not going to stop until we do. Could happen every 4 years. I actually agree with her.
Yeah, it's a rare day that I agree with a Cheney, with anybody with the last name Cheney, as you were saying in the opening remarks there of this segment. Politics makes strange bedfellows, they say, and this is one of the strangest ones, I have to admit.
Yeah, you know, we had Joe Walsh, the former congressman from Illinois, on the program the other day, and he came out and said that that Kevin McCarthy's a moron. And Nancy Pelosi said the same thing. I go, look at this. Nancy Pelosi and Joe Walsh agree on something. Kevin McCarthy's a moron. So you're right. Strange bedfellows. But this is the weird thing. I mean, you know, I'm watching Republican voters. I'm watching Republicans that I'm talking to who still they've bought the, you know, January 6th wasn't a big deal. And that everything that we're seeing was it's just a witch hunt.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that that's why they're being very careful about who they're going to be subpoenaing. We know that the chair of the 1-6 committee, Benny Thompson, has said that he and the committee are going to be in close contact with Attorney General Merrick Garland over what materials they can get from the Department of Justice and the White House. And as you know, Department of Justice came out yesterday and said, we aren't going to assert executive privilege for former DOJ Trump officials. They can testify freely,
right,
if they need to. And I think that that was a very important, seemingly obvious thing that should be normal, but hasn't been normal for us for the past 4 years. And I think that, you know, they have to kind of do this in a manner not only that is following the facts so that it doesn't seem like they're doing this politically, making these subpoenas a political thing, excuse me, but that they also have to be in conjunction and work closely with the Department of Justice so they don't step on their toes.
Right. But here's my problem. I know they've got subpoena power and all of that stuff, and, you know, they can do what they've got to do. My problem is I know when they've given subpoenas in the past, that these folks never testify.
Yeah, no, and we'll see it go to court. But fortunately, we now have a Department of Justice who's not going to assert executive privilege and who is not going to fight on behalf of the former administration to prevent people from testifying. I don't think we'll see what a lot of people want to see, which is people who would be arrested and or fined, with that inherent contempt thing that Congress is supposed to be able to do but hasn't done in 100 years. I hope nobody's really kind of expecting that to happen, because I don't see it happening.
I got a bunch of people who expect that. I go, for you and me, yeah, if they subpoena you or me, we better get our behind there. But we're not in that elite class that can fight this for 4, 5, 6 years down the road.
No, correct. We aren't. And we have to remember recently what it took 2 years to eventually get the testimony of Don McGahn. But again, we won't have the Department of Justice you know, a Bill Barr sticking their nose in and saying executive privilege.
Right. Now, the thing that gets me is, you know, you brought up, we talked about Cheney a moment ago, and, you know, Darth Cheney, I was expecting once Barack Obama took office, there to be an investigation into at least the aluminum tubes and all the lies that got us into Iraq. That didn't happen. It didn't happen, you know, during the Reagan years with Iran-Contra. Didn't happen during the Nixon years. We've never held anyone accountable. Why is this moment different? Because I've taken the position, we just haven't done it. Why is now different?
Well, why is now more important, or why do you think we will this time?
Why do you think we will this time? I know why. I want to hold everybody accountable so that the next time we don't have to keep doing this, because every time it seems to get worse and worse and worse. And this was pretty bad.
Yeah, well, I think we've seen some really big fat signals that at least the insiders of 1-6 are going to be held accountable. First of all, we had reporting back in February that they were investigating Roger Stone. That was from the New York Times, and his role in instigating or conspiring to instigate the attack on the Capitol. We've seen reportings from 302s where investigators have been asking if these boots on the ground terrorists, which is what they are, had any contact or discussions with members of Congress. So that means they're investigating members of Congress. And then recently in this DOJ filing that, you know, where they say we're not going to represent Mo Brooks in the Swalwell lawsuit, they said, we are currently investigating this. We're currently looking into this. And so right now, you know, we're going to say that we're not going to, you know, we're not going to replace the United, you know, Mo Brooks with the United States in this lawsuit. We're not going to give him immunity here because his speech at the Ellipse was a campaign speech, which is not covered in his scope of his duties. But further, if the court doesn't like that reason, he instigated an attack on the Capitol. And that's what's being alleged in this complaint by Swalwell. And until the court concludes that he didn't do that, he shouldn't be certified by the United States. He shouldn't be represented by the Department of Justice, because instigating a coup is the opposite of your duty as a member of Congress. It's so far outside of the scope. And they said, we're looking into this, and no federal employee should be covered by us. So they kind of hinted a little bit that we're not going to cover Trump. We're not going to cover Trump Jr. We're not going to cover anybody who worked for the government who had incendiary things to say that could have instigated the attack on the Capitol, until you prove, the courts, until you can conclude that what is alleged in these complaints did not happen. So I do have faith that they're looking at the generals here, which is what happened when, you know, they were given closing statements during the hearing yesterday. And all the officers were like, please, we can't investigate the people who incited this. We need you to do it. But we also have to be careful to do it in a way that doesn't step on the criminal investigation toes of the Department of Justice, like with what happened with Oliver North, et cetera, when we kind of dug our own grave on the criminal prosecution by having people come out into a congressional inquiry, which, you know, doesn't really have any consequences.
So which, you know, because I've said that, you know, this committee, I don't know, is going to get anywhere. I don't know we're going to get anything out of this. For me, it's the Department of Justice pursuing these criminal charges. That's how I think we end up going there. This is how you maybe get Trump to have to testify. I had someone the other day tell me Trump's going to have to testify in front of this committee. And I said, I rarely say never, but there's no way Trump is never going to testify in front of this committee. Never.
No, I concur. But in a criminal investigation, he would be compelled by the court to be deposed, right? So we need to let that happen. And it's more important, I'm with you, that the Department of Justice does the criminal investigation here than a congressional investigation. And I had said from the beginning, just don't do this in Congress. Set up a special counsel, set up an independent counsel to look at this. But this is what the Department of Justice is doing. The Department of Justice is doing what an independent counsel would do.
Yeah, but my problem is I'll be honest, I was not a Merrick Garland fan when Barack Obama pulled him out as his Supreme Court justice pick. Very moderate guy, you know, center of the road, you know, institutionalist, if you will. Was not thrilled when Joe Biden pulled him out. I know a lot of my lefty friends are, oh, we're going to show them. not so much. Are my concerns that he's an institutionalist, much like Mueller was, and I don't think you're going to get much movement out of them. Are my concerns valid, or do you think I'm being overly cautious?
I think your concerns are valid, given what we've had to go through. Everybody's kind of feeling that way. And, you know, I have three glaring red lines for Merrick Garland where I will snatch my support or even tepid support in an instance. And the first one was if they decided to represent Mo Brooks. They didn't do that, so they didn't cross that red line. The second one is if the Department of Justice announces that they will not pursue charges of obstruction of justice against the former president. They have it all laid out for them in volume 2 of the Mueller report. Mueller, conservative Mueller, wants these charges to be pursued, and he set this up and teed it up for that very exact specific purpose. Merrick Garland doesn't go after that. That's a dereliction of duty, in my opinion. You could even say, a lot of folks say, well, they might get him in New York. He go to jail in New York, so we don't have to do that. You have to do that. It was the same with the impeachment. You know, well, the Senate will never convict. That doesn't mean you don't do your duty.
Right.
You'd be derelict in your duty if you didn't go after those charges. And the third line would be if they represented Trump in the Swalwell lawsuit, which they pretty much made very clear would not happen when they gave the Mo Brooks explanation for why they wouldn't certify him. So two out of three so far, that last red line still remains for me personally. He towed that line with the E. Jean Carroll case and the Lafayette Square case. But those were decisions made by the last Justice Department, and he seems hell-bent on upholding decisions they made to not make it look political and overturn what they decided. But his arguments were terrible on both of those cases. And of course, when he held back the second half of that Bill Barr memo, asked for a stay so that he didn't have to release that under deliberative process privilege because he didn't want to overturn the prior Justice Department. But these Mo Brooks decisions, these new decisions, are his alone to make, and he's making the right call on them. It's just the old ones that I'm worried about.
Yeah. And again, you know, we had my friend Will Bunch, a national columnist with the Philly Inquirer on Monday, and he wrote in the piece, which was brilliant, the Democrats counter a GOP willing to smash the guardrails of democracy with cautious drivers who won't veer near the double yellow lines. That's how I view Merrick Garland right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, we'll see. Like there were a lot of hints dropped this week with the Mo Brooks decision and the decision to not assert executive privilege against former Trump officials. That to me says we're here to cooperate. And something else that this 1-6 commission I think would be really good at getting is all the documents, the phone logs, the things that can prove. Jim Jordan just admitted on television he talked to Trump. We can see those phone logs. We'll be able to get that and understand it. More so than I think any testimony that we ever wish we could get, like from Rudy Giuliani or Mo Brooks or Jim Jordan or Trump Jr. or Trump himself. I'm with you on that. I think they can subpoena all they want. I don't think that it's going to be an easy road to get those folks in. And even if you do get those folks in, you can't really ask questions that can interfere with the criminal investigation into the incitation of the insurrection. So there might be a lot of behind closed doors depositions with meetings with the Department of Justice as to what can be released to the public. But their job is to figure out what happened. And Merrick Garland's job is to prosecute people for breaking the law. And I hope he does. And I think he is. But and I'm reserving judgment until we find out whether he is or not.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, I want the criminal stuff. Even if New York does try and convict Trump, I still think you have to go after this simply for the messaging of the future so that this kind of behavior stops. Because, look, every Republican president in my lifetime has had significant crimes leaving office that we just said, let sleeping dogs lie.
Yeah. No, but, you know, I talked to Andy McCabe at length about this, and he told me, and he said in his book, The Threat, he said, look, when we opened the Trump-Russia investigation, we had a predication that crime could have been committed. And if we didn't open that investigation, given Manafort, given Flynn, given Gates, we would have been derelict in our duty. And we can't be derelict in our duty. And I have to imagine that the DOJ Garland envisions also has that philosophy. We have to and we must. And not just because it's our duty, but like you said, we can't let this go because we will be sending the message that a president can obstruct justice, can incite an insurrection, can conspire on a domestic terror attack on the Capitol without facing consequences. And he's been very, very clear about not, you know, about that being a problem and nobody being above the law. But we'll see if he holds that line.
Yeah, the Nixon in line. If the president doesn't, it's not illegal. We've kind of, at this point, we're kind of at that moment. But I like what Jamie Raskin said during an interview. He said they want to find out who organized it, mobilized it, who financed it, how they did it, why they did it, and are we still under a threat today? I want to find out who funded this stuff. Do we get to know that? I mean, by subpoenaing all these records, do we find these billionaires? Do we find the Mike Lindells and the Publix woman and all these groups that funded this stuff?
Well, I think that the Department of Justice is more equipped to do that kind of follow the money investigation with the amount of prosecutors and FBI agents, et cetera, that they have. But I mean, there are a lot of talented people on this commission and they have a huge gang of lawyers, I'm sure, who can help look into this. But, you know, a lot of these folks aren't prosecutors. They aren't law enforcement. And they, you know, they might have a little bit of a harder time following the money. But I hope either way we find out, whether it's through a criminal speaking indictment from the Department of Justice or whether it's through a report from the 1-6 Commission.
Yeah, last question I've got for you. You know, in looking at this, I know a lot of people are excited there. Oh, my, we're going to go get them. Is this a go get them thing, or is this just we're going to get a report at the end with the who, what, and why and all that, and it's not going to lead to any perp walking or any of that stuff?
No, it wouldn't lead to any perp walking. Of course, they can make criminal referrals to the Department of Justice, but it has to be assumed that the Department of Justice knows more than this committee will ever know or could ever know. So it would be sort of like telling them stuff they already, like, yes, thank you. We know, and we're already six steps ahead of you on that. So no, I don't think you'll see any perp walks. This is to find out what happened, like you said, who funded it. And those are important things to know to prevent the next one from happening. But the best thing we can do to prevent the next one from happening is put people in jail.
I am right there with you. And starting with the former guy, to me, it's that simple. But Allison, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope folks will check out your podcast, Mueller, She Wrote, and The Daily Beans. In fact, you got a whole slew of podcasts, don't you?
Yeah, we just started a network called MSW Media. With a bunch of great shows on there, including Greg Oliar and Glenn Kirshner, Renato Mariotti. And then, of course, I love your show. And thank you so much for everything that you do, because I think that the information that you bring to the people is crucial and critical. And the best thing that we can do to hold this Department of Justice's feet to the fire is to talk and to talk loudly at them.
Good stuff. Allison, I appreciate the time as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Dr. Allison Gill. Make sure you check out her work. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day that flames burnt in the U.S. Capitol. The U.S. Armed Forces set fire to a shanty town of unemployed World War I veterans. The veterans had come to the Capitol to demand the bonus that they had been promised for their service. The payment was not due until 1945. But the nation was in the throes of the Great Depression. Desperate veterans demanded the bonus be paid early. Walter W. Walters, a veteran and unemployed former cannery worker, called for his fellow veterans to go to Washington, D.C. and demand payment. From across the country, veterans answered the call. Many hopped trains to make their way to the nation's capital. They called themselves the Bonus Expeditionary Force. This echoed the American Expeditionary Force, the name for U.S. troops that had fought in France during World War I. In May, the veterans began to arrive in Washington, D.C. They set up tents and shelters in vacant lots and open spaces. The largest encampment was along the Anacostia River. Some in Washington began to warn that the 8,000 protesters of the Bonus Army were led by communists. But retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler came to the camp to encourage the protesters. He said,
"I never saw such fine Americanism as is exhibited by you people. You have just as much right to have a lobby here as any steel corporation. Makes me so damn mad a whole lot of people speak of you as tramps. By God, they didn't speak of you as tramps in 1917 and 18. No.
But Army Chief of Staff General MacArthur was less sympathetic. He ordered troops to clear out the veterans. With cavalry, tanks, rifles, and tear gas, they ousted the protesters and burnt the Anacostia River encampment to the ground.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you got to love the fact that the governor of Iowa, this Kim Reynolds, because we're seeing a spike in the COVID variant in a number of states. You've got Texas, you've got Florida, you've got Missouri, Iowa, you know, coming up there as well. So you got to find a boogie person. You got to find the boogeyman, the whodunit. And the whodunit is all of these illegals. These illegals who are coming in, these migrants who are unvaccinated coming from Mexico. And I'm going, hold on. I think we can look a lot closer to home to half of the dimwits who are proudly saying they're never getting vaccinated right here at home. I think we can blame them first and then go after the boogeyman. Just kind of a thought. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on our good senator from Arizona, Dipsy Doo, and the fact that we might not get an infrastructure bill at all. Which is scary to me and angering. I've asked our good friend Peter Morley to come talk with us. Peter is a patient advocate, survivor, and one of my favorite people on the Twitters and a good friend. Peter, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, always for you. It's been way too long. It's wonderful to be reunited with you and happy to lend my voice to you anytime.
We need to get this human infrastructure in place. And the story today is, you know, the Republicans, there's a bipartisan deal. We might get some roads and bridges, maybe. But the other part of it was we're going to move this other bill through budget reconciliation. And it seemed like things were going in the right direction. Maybe we were going to get them both. Now you got Kristen Simina coming out saying, no, I'm not in favor of the bigger bill. And my first thought was, are we going to get a little dance out of her like she did with the minimum wage that she shot down? Because this is horrible. This could be horribly painful for a whole bunch of people who desperately need help.
Well, I can't comment on her thoughts, but I just want to say it is not that you're aware of this because it feels like I've been doing this for like 20 years, but for the last 4 years, it's almost exactly four. Actually, it was 4 years. That I've been traveling to DC. And how did I get to DC? I got to DC on an Amtrak train. And you know what Amtrak is? Infrastructure. I got on a Amtrak train that got me to DC to talk to the senators, to be in that 5:15 meeting in John McCain's office when he did the thumbs down. That was infrastructure. Healthcare is infrastructure. We were talking about hospitals, we're talking about PPE, we're talking about supply chains, we're talking about NIH research, we're talking about what I've spoken to members about. I've had a lot of meetings with members recently because I'm doing this tour of the Northeast, and hopefully the Delta variant won't curtail that. But we're talking about specifically when you talk about healthcare. The thing that's gotten me through these last months has been having telehealth. And you know what? Telehealth is infrastructure because it is broadband. And I mean, I would have put my health at great risk if I had to go and see my doctors in person during the height of the pandemic. And the pandemic may reach new heights. I mean, who knows? But the important thing to remember is everything that is infrastructure is healthcare, and everything that is healthcare affects your health, whether you know it or acknowledge it or not.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing that gets me is, you know, everything you laid out there, I'm missing where the hippie liberal stuff is and where all the unnecessary spending was, because all we're hearing from the right is, oh, that's all, you know, wish list socialism. And now you've got, you know, Sinema who's coming out going, well, you know, that's, man, it's too much. Look, we've had decades of no investment. We're way behind. We need something big. We need something bold. We need something visionary. Sadly, she doesn't seem to be it.
Well, I just don't, you know, I mean, they're, I mean, what about the people in rural America? What about the people, like, how do we reach them? How do we, how, I mean, I'm a healthcare advocate. I'm a patient too with chronic illness, but how do we reach those people in rural America? Like, how are we supposed to get to them without infrastructure? I mean, that is the crux of our economy. And if it's crumbling, how are we going to fix it? How are we going to help millions of Americans? So I can't believe that this is depending on her. That's what it's like. It's always depending on someone. I mean, the names change, but it's just like it's always comes down to one person.
Yeah, and that's the sad thing. And look, as you said, you know, it's healthcare. It's transportation. It's also education. It's also taking care of our seniors. It's also helping the disabled community. It's looking at how to save our planet by moving us in a direction to address climate change. There's so much that has to be done, and to say no, we have to do this on the cheap, to me, is just kind of insane.
No, I agree. I mean, that's why I'm doing this whole effort called Healthcare Awareness Month. You know, every month should be Healthcare Awareness Month. And I realize it's a huge, general, large umbrella. But when you talk about Healthcare Awareness Month, we're going to make it for August. And actually, there's talk about making it a resolution on the House floor. Maybe that'll get through instead of infrastructure. I mean, who knows with the way Congress works. But the whole point behind the Healthcare Awareness Month is to take the legislation that is going on right now in Congress and to amplify it, because there are good things coming out of Congress. I mean, there's talk about, you know, expanding Medicare and including vision and dental and things for medical durable equipment, lowering drug prices, expanding Medicaid. These are things that should have been done years ago, and they finally have the, maybe they will get done in this bill. But infrastructure is the core for everything. So for it not to even not the thought of it not getting done is unfathomable. And as somebody who relies on infrastructure, we all rely on infrastructure every single day of our lives, whether we know it or not. It's just I just have no words.
Now, she did say that she's going to negotiate. She's going to work really hard. You know, she didn't want to deflate, you know, too many hopes, but, you know, she's going to work real hard.
Well, I'm glad she is. And I'm working really hard, too, to try to amplify these efforts, because I think our members of Congress still need our help. And unfortunately, what I've found in the 117th Congress is I found a lot of people are putting themselves in the back burner, and we can't do that. We got to hold their feet to the fire. We have to hold whatever party it is, we have to hold them accountable. We have to say, hey, you know, you gotta do what's right for every American, because this is, like you said, I mean, our roads, our bridges, our hospitals, I mean, they're crumbling. I mean, some of our hospitals are closing. I mean, how are we supposed to help people? How are we supposed to help people of all socioeconomic backgrounds? I mean, how are we supposed to do this?
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, Peter. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. But here's the weird thing, and this is where, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, Joe Biden has, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, pushing the idea that we're going to expand, as you said, the things for Medicare, vision, dental, all of that, also expanding Medicaid. All of these things are going to overwhelmingly help red states, the people who voted against him. And, you know, I know it's a huge departure from the former guy, but, you know, I don't even believe that Biden's doing it because he thinks he's going to get them to vote for him. I think he's doing it because, look, it's the right thing for the country. It's the thing that's going to help us move forward as a nation.
You know, the thing that keeps me up at night, Rick, are all of the people that could have been helped during COVID, all the people that died by the non-expansion of Medicaid states, those red states that you had mentioned that should have been expanded, and their governors and their state houses decided we're not going to expand Medicaid, even though they had the money there to expand it. They decided they're not going to do it. And these people during this pandemic died. Yeah. And even before the pandemic died, because they fell into what they call the Medicaid gap, and they didn't exactly have enough tax credits for, I mean, they had, they just fell into not even qualifying for Medicaid and having too many, too much income for the ACA marketplace. So that's what happens when you don't have an expanded Medicaid state.
And even if the voters want it, I look at Missouri, where the voters said they wanted it. The governor's like, no, not doing it.
And I don't even know what to say there. I mean, it's just like, we got to keep the pressure on. We got to keep that grassroots efforts alive. I mean, we got it. I realize that the person who shall be named, who shall not be named, we still need, I mean, the great thing about those years is that there was so much unity. There was so much fight. There was so much, I mean, we really got to get back to that. I mean, I haven't stopped. I know you haven't stopped, but a lot of people have stopped because there's something called complacency that unfortunately they stop for that. And we can't stop. So many people that need help. There are millions of Americans that need help. And now with these COVID long haulers, I mean, you know, and God knows there'll be additional ones every single day. I think the latest report I read is that at least 10% of people who've had COVID will be a COVID long hauler. And then I hear stories of people applying for programs like Social Security Disability that are being turned down. And you know how that works. When you apply for Social Security Disability, 60% of those people get turned down the first time. And by the time they get approved, they're dead. And what are you supposed to do? So there's just so many things. I know we're talking about infrastructure, but that is part of our infrastructure. Healthcare is infrastructure. I can't say it enough. And right. That's what we're doing in Healthcare Awareness Month.
No, and that's the important thing, because you look, when normally when we think of infrastructure, we're thinking roads and bridges and, you know, the woman from, you know, the governor from South Dakota, you know, pipes and, you know, we're thinking about, the hard stuff. What we've neglected and what deliberately has been neglected is the human capital, the human infrastructure, the things that take care of people. The fact that we don't have long-term health care in this country for people as they get older, especially a country that is getting older, is to me criminal. The fact that we're going back to a point where people could, you know, live out their lives destitute is just, in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, to me is just flat wrong.
You know, we just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the ADA, and it's just... And even that program, as wonderful as it is, and, you know, it was signed into law on my birthday on July 26th. It's just amazing that you know, it's still like, you know, it was attacked under the Trump administration, and it still could use some enhancements, and it's still not being implemented in certain parts of this country. And in even, you know, here in New York, it still hasn't been fully implemented. People really take it for granted. But I mean, there's so many enhancements to that. And as somebody who lives with disabilities, I mean, it breaks my heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's we have so much to do, and we could do so much more, but we have a political system, Peter, that is just mired in conflict. And we as a people are divided constantly. They throw these divisive issues deliberately to keep us pitted against one another. So we never get to the places where we want to go.
Well, I mean, you know, I agree with you. And I just will reiterate, which I've probably said on your show countless times, but Senator Patty Murray, the wonderful senator from Washington, the head of the Senate Health Committee, she told me that really one story can make a difference. So I really, really love to emphasize storytelling. Storytelling is so important. And I talk about the fact that I live with chronic illness. I live with lupus. It's a struggle for me to get out of bed. And, you know, it's still not easy for me. And I also live with anxiety. And, you know, I can say that to you, and I could say that to your listeners. I could say that to millions and millions of people. But there are people that aren't comfortable saying it. And I'm encouraging them, if they're listening right now, that they think that their voice doesn't matter, but it does. Because if your voice changes that one person's mind, like if it changes Senator Sennenham's mind of her, you know, if it changes her mind to rethink this and stop playing games with this bill, then that'll save millions, millions and millions of Americans' lives. So it's so crucial to tell your story and make your voice be heard, because your voice does matter. Every voice matters, and never let anyone tell you that it doesn't.
There you go.
And before we end our segment, I know we're coming to a close, but I did want to introduce you to the wonderful joy and love of my life, Angelica, the dog who strangely has 5,500 followers on Twitter. And she brings me so much joy and grounds me on a daily basis. And this is your Uncle Rick, Angelica. Angelica the dog, for anyone who wants to follow her. But you need to find your own Angelica there and help have somebody ground you on a daily basis, because it really makes an impactful difference in your life. Maybe Senator Sinema needs Angelica in her life.
Well, what we should do is we'll send her the Twitter handle, and maybe she'll follow along, and maybe she'll find her way. But Peter, beautiful dog, I wish you the best. It's always great talking with you. As you have the month of action coming up in August, we'd love to have you back to share some thoughts and go through some of the actions that you're working on.
I would absolutely love that. It's at Healthcare Month. For those of you who want to follow along, I would greatly appreciate it. We're going to have just amazing on-the-ground events. Again, hopefully COVID won't curtail those. But thank you so much, Rick, for having me on your show. Always such a pleasure. And it's such an honor to speak to an incredible patriot like yourself.
Thanks, Peter. I appreciate it, man. Peter Morley, good friend of the show. Make sure you check out Angelica the dog. Also, when the Health Awareness Month comes around, we're going to most certainly talk about that. Quick break. Right back to the car.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. Silk workers in Paterson, New Jersey ended their unsuccessful six-month strike. By 1900, Paterson had won the nickname Silk City. Skilled weavers, ribbon weavers in particular, were proud of their craft. They were tenacious in fighting for the respect and decent wages they thought they deserved. Earlier that spring, these skilled ribbon weavers united all of the silk workers and went on strike. The strikers' main demand was a call for the 8-hour workday. The strikers were aided by members of the industrial workers of the world, most notably Big Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. The strike also drew attention from intellectuals in Greenwich Village in New York. In fact, some time after the strike started, many of the Greenwich villagers came to Paterson to observe the strike firsthand. They were impressed by the solidarity among the many nationalities of the silk workers and the courage of the strikers. The strike spread to other towns in New Jersey, as well as Pennsylvania, New York, and Connecticut. Meanwhile, by May, the Greenwich villagers were working on what they called the Paterson Pageant. They hoped to bring public attention to the workers' struggles by staging a dramatic performance of the strike. On June 7th, Madison Square Garden was overflowing with 15,000 audience members and more filling the standing room only. Yet, while the Patterson pageant did bring money into the strike fund, this was not enough to help all of the workers on strike. Finally, the strikers returned to work. They were able to get a 9-hour workday at most job sites, but the elusive quest for the 8-hour day remained incomplete. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.